We'll call this meeting to order for Wednesday, March 29th. We have a quorum. Doug is out on family business. So, Bill, it's just you and I.
Okay.
So the Brock, we have a recognition and proclamation, or proclamation Sheriff's Office Accreditation Award certified by Oregon Accreditation Alliance.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Ed Boyd, and I am privileged to be the Executive Director of the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. I also spent just under 27 years in law enforcement with the Salem and Albany Police Department, where I retired as the Chief in 2013. I want to thank Sheriff Landers for his invitation here today. I'm very honored to be speaking before this board, and I'm pleased to be here to present the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office with their original award of State Law Enforcement Accreditation. Accreditation is all about standards. Our profession, our agencies, are all about standards. We have standards to become a law enforcement officer, standards to graduate from the police academy, standards to be certified as an officer or deputy, and standards for the varying levels of certification that we hold through the Department of Public Safety standards and training. We continually preach and demand standards of accountability, standards of performance, and standards of conduct. Accreditation means that an agency, their operations, management, policies, and procedures meet the best practices that the industry has to offer. The accreditation process in general is a progressive and contemporary way of helping law enforcement agencies evaluate and improve their overall performance and provides formal and professional recognition that an organization meets or exceeds best practice expectations of service and quality in the profession. To be accredited, an agency must meet 104 professional standards comprised of over 400 separate requirements contained within those standards. Once an agency is accredited, they must undergo a reevaluation review and on-site inspection every 3 years to ensure ongoing compliance with all required standards. In Oregon currently, right at 35% of all law enforcement agencies are currently involved in the accreditation program, and just a little over 24% of Oregon agencies currently hold state accreditation. There are currently 62 law enforcement and 911 agencies involved in the accreditation program, and we currently have 41 accredited agencies in the state. It also, in my opinion, takes courage for an organization to take on the rigorous accreditation process to begin with. Anytime the chief executive officer of an organization invites an outside third party into their department to review and inspect everything associated with their operations and render an opinion as to whether they meet a best set of practice expectations, that by itself shows commitment, transparency, and a dedication to excellence. The Lincoln County Sheriff's Office joined the Oregon Accreditation Alliance in February of 2011. This is their first and original award of law enforcement accredited status. It is through the commitment and direction of chiefs, sheriffs, and 911 directors that their respective agencies undertake the rigorous accreditation process to begin with. And although it is truly an agency-wide effort to make it happen, specific recognition needs to be given to the accreditation managers, the point people who really make this happen. Special recognition goes to Accreditation Manager Sergeant Mark Meister for his outstanding work in preparing the Sheriff's Office for the recent on-site and file review. It is now my distinct honor and pleasure to present Sheriff Curtis Landers with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office with their first award of law enforcement accreditation. Sheriff Landers, on behalf of the Oregon Accreditation Board of Directors, it is my privilege and honor to present you with your accreditation award from the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. Congratulations, sir.
Guys, can you tip that down just a tad?
Okay, perfect.
And just don't move.
All right.
Okay. All right, let's try that one more time. Big smiles, guys. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well,
good morning, Commissioners. Sheriff Curtis Landers.
Good morning.
and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you, Director Boyd, for making the trip over today and presenting this to us. I'd also like to really recognize Sergeant Meister again for he was very instrumental in finishing the accreditation process and putting everything in place for our on-site and file inspections. So he definitely should be commended for his work that he's done on this project. Like it was talked about, we started the process back in 2011. We probably took a little longer than most agencies. We had some things come up in the middle. I initially started the process when I was the administrative lieutenant under Sheriff Dotson. Worked on it, got to a certain spot. Other things would kind of get in kind of a priority way, and when I came into office, we had assigned Sergeant Mark Meister to be the accreditation manager and finish it up, and he took that initiative and saw it through to completion.
Well, tell me how they go about doing this and what it means in your department.
Well, I think one of the best ways to put it, at least that's how I try to explain it, because we get asked a lot of times is, you know, why be accredited? What does it mean for the department? And I think one of the best ways to put it is you know, we're looking at policing in the 21st century, and things are ever-changing, and we want to make sure we're following best practices. The one thing that the Accreditation Alliance does is it makes sure that the best practices are followed from a comprehensive review. And I think to put it real clearly is that it shows that an agency has a policy for best practice or a standard, and that the agency actually follows that policy. It's one thing to have a policy and say you follow it, but what happens is they come in and make ensure that you are actually following the policy and best practice the way it should be done. So I think that's the best way to do it, to ensure your agency is following those best practices. And they do change from time to time and make sure that you're complying with the current best practice as we move into 21st century policing.
So how common is this?
It's actually very uncommon. As I mentioned, only about 22% of all law enforcement agencies in Oregon are currently accredited. Depending on which list you look at and who's providing that list, there's currently 170, 171 police agencies in the state of Oregon, and only 41 of those agencies are accredited right now. We have two more that are going to meet that threshold here in the next couple of months, but it's still a very select few that do get involved with it and actually accomplish it. And that those statistics are pretty common from state to state.
Are they common throughout the state? Are most of them in Portland, or are they urban or rural? Or
they're all over the place, sir.
Good.
All over the place, and that's what we really, really enjoy. Our smallest accredited agency is three officers, a chief and two officers. So, you know, that's a big step for them to take that on and achieve that as well. It's a very rigorous process, but it's there for a reason. Accreditation has actually been in existence in the United States for over 200 years and originally came about as in the areas of medicine and education to make sure that you know, the diploma mills and that everybody was meeting the same standards. Law enforcement actually started looking at accreditation very hard back in the late 60s, but it didn't really get going until the 80s. And again, as Sheriff Landers mentioned, it's basically a set of best practice standards that are continually reviewed to make sure that they are consistent with the best practices across the United States. And they not only have to have the policies that say that they do it, we come and verify and that they prove that they do what they say they do.
What an accomplishment.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, gentlemen.
And thanks for your whole team. I know that just doesn't happen by just the sheriff. It's no. Your whole department that has to work on a project like that.
Exactly.
So, thank you. We move down to the consent calendar, and consent calendar items are things of a routine nature. We previously heard. Is there anything you'd like to highlight or delete?
No, Mr. Chair. I would make a motion to adopt the consent calendar as presented.
Okay, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We have a decision and action item authorizing the Parks Division of Lincoln County Public Works Department to apply to Oregon State Parks for a grant for the purpose of developing the Brown Memorial Park. Do you want to come forward? Be sure and say who you are. We all know you, but...
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Keith Andreessen. I am the Parks Operations Supervisor for Lincoln County. What we have before you today is asking your approval to get the right to apply for a grant from the state parks. Is funded by the Oregon State Lottery dollars. It is the local government grant that is open to multiple government agencies and associations. With this grant, we are able to apply the property value as part of the match. As you'll see noted in the budget on the top there, the property land value comes in at...
Can you stop me for a second?
Sure.
Most of the public doesn't even know where Brown Memorial Park is. So would you give us a little basic background?
Okay, Brown Memorial Park is on the Siletz River. It is about 13 and a half miles up from Kernville. It is adjacent to the Strome Park facility. Walter Brown donated it to the county, and the county received clear title to the property back in 2012. The process of design and development for this facility has been in the works since then. We have put in a well back in the early part of the development process. This will tie in for the new structures as we move ahead. But the Strome, if you can see the map here, you can the top right-hand side shows the loop and the boat ramp. That is the facility that is there in place right now. These two parks are on the same parcel with the process of getting clear title to the land. They were combined under one tax lot. So in the grant process, the value of the land was considered only as the donated portion of the property, not including any of the improvements or structures that are associated with Strome Park. The campground facilities was laid out. We hired the a consultant that did us these colored drawings and renditions and helped us fit in needed facilities and structures. The lower part of the map shows an area of cabins, a covered structure. That is the phase two portion. We are working towards the phase one, which is the campground, the big open section in the center. We'll have restroom facilities there. Most of the ground is flat, so pretty much all of the campground will meet ADA access. We will still have one ADA designated campsite. We're moving forward with having an on-site host in those area on that area, and it will operate similarly to what Jack Morgan Park operates right now.
So how long is it going to take to develop this? I've been learned a lesson in this last park we're trying to develop that I may be an old man before some of these parks begin
this existence. This grant is a two-year window. I'm working with the county engineer, Steve Hodges, on helping get all of the permits lined up to be able to go out and apply for them. Once we get the grant, we move forward with the permits. They are not as in-depth a permit because there is no in-water work. You know, everything, as you can see, is back from the water. The trails that are there will not directly impact the river. So basically the idea is we get the grant, we get 2 years to complete the grant. The grant is awarded somewhere in the midsummer, usually in July, first part of August. Then you have 2 years to complete the project after that process.
Okay. And this development, again, is... just please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's in line with what Mr. Brown envisioned when he made the donation to the county in 2012. I recall that he wanted to have facilities like this so people could enjoy the property, but at the same time really preserving its natural character to the greatest degree possible.
Yes, that is this is the first step, is getting the campground facility in. the part of the one of the requirements of this grant is that you have a usable product at the end of the grant. So with, you know, talking with Wayne and with Roy, we came up with moving forward with the campground, which is the one of the easier portions of the project to get completed to start with. One of the things that Mr. Brown wanted was a center where people could come together to have meetings or have stuff. So that's why we've got designed in there a covered structure in the lower area, which is in laid in its phase two, which will include showers and then cabins where they could possibly come in as groups or such. We also have plans to be able to put in some group areas that would be open to family groups for family reunion, the Boy Scouts if they wanted to come use the property and such.
Wayne, you worked with Mr. Brown more than any of us, and because this is kind of a heritage park for him, you want to give a quick description of Walter and why he did this?
Well, this was actually, I think, originally was property he bought many years ago that he had replanted with different species in there. And a beautiful piece of property along the river. He actually owns property on the other side of the river as well as on the highway side, and actually owns some property on which we have a conservation easement over that's even north of the highway. So it's a fairly large parcel of land. And when his spouse passed away, Barbara passed away, one of the things they had talked about was leaving a legacy, something that would be available to kind of fulfill a vision of theirs of having a beautiful setting along the river that would both preserve the natural area there and, as Keith was saying, allow for development of a park that would be utilized by groups and individuals, really take advantage of that beautiful natural setting in there. Walter was a very interesting guy, an attorney, a former Senate, member of the Oregon Senate, also a JAG Corps attorney, as well as a law professor. I remember when this first came through, Rob Bovet was my assistant at that time, and we felt like we were in Real Estate Law 101 back in law school when Walter was talking to us about the transaction and how he wanted to set this thing up. We were both sitting at a whiteboard, and he was kind of explaining his stuff going through it. It was quite an experience. Walter's an interesting guy. Unfortunately, the property got involved in some litigation. It took a number of years to kind of settle out what was going on, which is what really took us quite a long time to get to this stage, a lot longer than we had hoped. But we're there, and this is, I think, really the implementation of Walter's vision for the park and our vision for the county, too.
So if I understand right, it wasn't just Walter, it's his wife, too.
It's actually, the name of the park is the Barbara S. and Walter F. Brown Memorial Park.
Okay. Even though Mr. Brown is still with us.
He's still with us, but that's the name that they desired for the park.
So, and going with that, I hope we can keep... So many parks get a name on it, and then soon after, everybody forgets what the name was there for or why.
Not included in this grant, but one of his original wishes was a memorial plaque. That is still in the process. I will work through Wayne, contact Mr. Brown on how he wants the wording on that, and it has been talked whether we put up a sign or have a rock put up with a big brass plaque on it. That has not been decided as yet, but this will be something that I will be working on too, and working with Mr. Brown to see.
You don't have to go very far to find a rock there.
No. Well, yeah. they're just down the road, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So we need a formal action on this?
Yeah, I did. I'm sorry, it's not in your pack. But
it's been distributed before the meeting.
So we actually have a resolution that would authorize the Parks Division to apply for this grant.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we adopt the proposed resolution authorizing the Parks Division of the Lincoln County Public Works Department to apply to the Oregon State Parks Department for grant funds for the purpose of developing Brown Memorial Park.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Okay. We get out of reports, and the first report was supposed to be for the canine program, but apparently we have a sick dog.
Deputy Bonnie is ill today, so she can't be here. And we don't want to have the report without the dog.
Okay, so we'll go down to item two, the Oregon Department of Forestry update. And please introduce yourself.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Ted Erdman. I'm the assistant district forester for the West Oregon District, Oregon Department of Forestry. I work out of Philomath. And first order of business for us here, Mike Toady, the district forester, my boss, he sends his regrets. He couldn't be with you this morning. He was told for an assignment to our state office for a couple of months, and so we had this on this appointment with you folks on the books prior to that assignment. So
he said voluntold. In other words, he was said, Mike, you're volunteering for this assignment, right? And
yeah.
He said, oh yes, of course.
He was asked, okay. But there really wasn't an option.
He got his name selected out of the hat, but his was the only one in it.
Yeah. these annual updates that we do with the three boards of commissioners in Benton, Polk, and Lincoln every spring are extremely important to him, and so anyway, he wanted to make sure that you understood that he really wanted to be here, but he couldn't. So we have a number of things that we wanted to cover quickly with you this morning here, and we're going to tag team that a little bit. Matt Thomas is the local manager here in our Toledo unit, and I think maybe somewhere in your packet there's a colorful organizational chart here. Maybe yours is black and white.
Yes.
Mine was upside down. Just to remind you, you know, how we're organized. So the West Oregon District, you know, we provide three operational field programs to portions of five counties, Lincoln, Benton, Polk, a little bit of Yamhill, and a very little bit of Tillamook. And so we're organized into those three units that you can see across the top there, Philomath, Dallas, and Toledo. And so Matt is the local manager here for the Toledo unit and provides those two of those three operational programs in Lincoln County. And so another thing that I'd like to note on the organizational chart, there are a few openings on our chart, one of which is in Toledo. One of our stewardship foresters is currently vacant there, and one of the things that I wanted to mention in just kind of a general update here is with the legislative session ongoing here and it's budget season, we as an agency made a decision, or were directed maybe is the appropriate term, to budget at the governor's recommended budget level. And in the governor's recommended budget, or maybe I should say not in the governor's recommended budget, was one stewardship forester for the West Oregon District. And so we, since we have a vacancy, plan to take that vacancy in Toledo if that ends up as part of the end budget here when the legislature is done. A second piece of that in the governor's recommended budget is a reduction of one of our seasonal firefighters. And those are in the big boxes kind of toward the bottom of your org chart there. We plan to take that vacancy somewhere in the valley, and that's yet to be determined. One other thing, interestingly enough, that is in the governor's recommended budget is a policy option package that we put in for what we're calling the Toledo Relocation Project. And so for some time, we've been discussing with our landowners the need to relocate our Toledo facility for a number of reasons. So this is kind of the next step in that process. That policy option package made it into the governor's recommended budget. And so, again, we'll have to wait and see come, you know, probably June, whenever the legislature gets done with their work, to see if it makes it into the legislatively approved budget. But I think you have been updated from time to time on bits and pieces of that, but it is a co-location project currently with ODOT that we're trying to work through, and at some point, if it does make it into the legislatively adopted budget, we've got a couple of parcels of land that we're thinking might suit our needs and ODOT's needs. That's yet to be determined, but at some point we'll need to be working with the planning department on rezoning or a variance or a conditional use permit or something along those lines somewhere down the road. So one other thing that I might mention, just in a general kind of an update here, our colorful district fire protection map that we produce is due for an update. We're currently in the process of updating that. And we fully expect to have that new version, the 2017 version, out prior to fire season this year is our goal. And that's necessitated by the ever-changing private landowner landscape out there. There have been some significant changes over the last couple of years in ownership that we want to make sure we capture on that map for everyone to use. So, thought we might just quickly tick down through the three operational programs here. I'm going to cover state forests quickly, and then Matt will take care of private forests and fire protection, and I think he's got a wonderful PowerPoint presentation here for you. But in state forests, I'll just remind you that we manage a little under 15,500 acres of Board of Forestry land for you all. We also manage a little over 4,000 acres of common school land for the Department of State Lands in Lincoln County. So right around 20,000 acres or so that we manage in Lincoln County as part of our program. And in the first two quarter payments for the current fiscal year, so that's July through December, We've delivered almost $650,000 to Lincoln County, and that's before you all split it out before the between the various taxing agencies. But that's the share that that we've given to you, and just so that's the first two quarters, right? An average over the last five fiscal years is right around $1.4 million per fiscal that we generate and distribute to you folks. But I would just want to remind you that that is highly variable based on a large number of factors you're probably familiar with there. But we do have five planned timber sales in the current fiscal year, in fiscal year 17. That we plan to harvest a little over 10 million board feet, and our estimate on the county revenue share portion is 2.2 million on that. But that'll come in over several fiscals just by the nature of the contracts and whatnot. For fiscal year 18, which we're currently in the planning process for the fiscal year 18 annual operations plan, and that plan is out for public comment right now as part of a annual process that we have. We have four timber sales planned in Lincoln County for a little over 7 million board feet, and our estimate of the county revenue share is just under $1.4 million there. Again, that would come in over several fiscals. So,
can I ask you a question?
You bet.
You quoted a number of 20,000 acres, and I look over here under forest land ownership in Lincoln County. State and public is quoted at 25,000 acres. What's the 5,000 acres consist of?
Is that on the O3 page that I provided there?
Probably county forest land count, so county, some land that you all own, city, watershed.
So all that's included in it. Okay, that's the difference. I was trying to figure out what the difference is.
Other public, yes.
I didn't know. I just
picked the... No, good question.
Thank you.
Good question.
Good morning, Commissioners. As Ted said, my name is Matt Thomas. I'm the local Toledo unit forester. I'll kind of take the private forest and the fire protection side of things here for our agency. So on the private forest side, locally here in Toledo, for 2016, so this last year, we were at about 550 notifications. That's fairly average for this area. In 2015, I think we were up in the 600 to 700 range, which was a little higher than normal. As we reported last year, some of that was due to the storm and trying to take care of some of the damage that occurred with that ice storm back in 2014. Is that right, Ted?
That's correct.
So we kind of leveled back out as far as notifications here in the county, right there in the 550-ish range. And that's anything from road construction, road maintenance, harvesting, and site prep as well. We're still in the continued improvement phase of our new online notification system. So all of our notifications for operations are done online now. You can either do it online at your home, or we do have a kiosk at each of our three offices, actually all of our offices around the state as well. But we're kind of in the continual improvement stage of that and just making sure that system evolves kind of with technology and through the changing times. So, which is a fairly big undertaking for the agency. I think they've been improving it since they started. I think that's a fair statement. Also on the private forest side, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the new stream rules that are eventually going to be implemented. Hopefully, I think we're looking somewhere in the July 1st range for the salmon steelhead bull trout streams. Essentially, those changes are in the small and medium fish streams. Basically changing the required buffers from 50 to 60 feet on a small and 70 to 80 feet on mediums. And then as well, essentially doubling the amount that you have to leave retention for basal area in those strips. I think that process, it's basically through the public comment phase and just needs to be formally adopted by the Board of Forestry later this spring. I think it is, right, Ted?
I think so.
Hopefully to be implemented July 1 of this year. Also, private forest-wise, our office has been engaged with the local Mid-Coast Water Partnership, just kind of a partnership with many constituents, Water Resources Department, Fish and Wildlife, our agency, just looking at kind of water as a whole here in the Mid-Coast, whether it be for drinking water, water storage, water quality, just kind of trying to get an overall plan. So we've been heavily involved with that, and I believe there's a meeting this evening as well. So any questions before I switch to fire protection?
I'm going to ask you, since you're the fire suppression man.
Okay.
There's a initiative that's come up here, and there's some questions about different things. I have a question. What's the difference in a burn rate? And you may not or know. A burn rate in an old-growth forest and a modern industrial forest. Do you have any idea what the difference is of how much land is burnt in a year? Probably not, but it's a question that I think is important.
As far as how much burns?
Yeah, how much...
Old growth versus managed forest?
You're managing, states managing a lot of forest lands. The Sayuse law is going to a late succession forestry where
sure.
It's old growth, and I wondered if it's a detectable difference in burn rates in the two different types of timber management styles.
A lot of it has to do with weather conditions and starts for fires as well. We could have really dry years and no starts, and that's going to skew the statistical numbers as well. Have you seen any formal numbers?
Not, I guess, that I could pull off the top of my head, but you know, locally, I can tell you that the Siuslaw National Forest, you know, fire statistics are they respond to less fires than we do on the lands that we protect, which is everything but national forest lands. So all the private and public and some other federal lands.
Okay, a lot of that's because there's more activity in the industrial forest than
that's part of it, certainly.
And if I understand right, old growth forests historically have burned larger fires over great distances, but very sporadically.
Very infrequently.
Yeah. But yes. When they do happen.
And a lot of that has to do with the fuel loading. There's just a tremendous amount of fuel loading, not only standing timber, but all the you know, litter on the ground and that kind of stuff as well. But it does take some significant weather event or drying, a long drying period, to have those catastrophic fires.
I realize that was a tough question, but I think you answered it.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
And to ask a question, Mr. Chair, you mentioned an initiative coming up, and there is, I'm sure you're already aware, an initiative on the May ballot, a citizen initiative that's designed to prohibit aerial application of herbicides. So can you talk about what current policy is? I mean, they, like, if a landowner does want to do an application, do they have to notify you in Toledo, in Philomath? Is the information then available publicly, either before or after the fact, when an application is done, where, how much, what kind of product, that sort of thing? So,
yeah, so that's part of those notifications that I talked about mm-hmm. earlier. So it is any herbicide application on timberland needs a notification, which basically that'll come to the office. Our stewardship forester will look over that for protected resources. So mostly water, you know, so and making sure that if they are spraying within a certain amount of feet of any protected resource, that there's a written plan usually with those that basically lays out how that operator is going to minimize the impact to those protected resources. All the notifications are public information. And can, you know, be requested through a public records request. But there's also a subscriber system that we've got, and basically that makes it to where if somebody chooses to be a subscriber, they come into the office, fill out a form, and there's a, I believe it's a minimum of a $25 fee per year, but they can choose the township range sections that they would like to receive notifications for, and those get either mailed to them directly from our office or emailed in with the new system.
I want to learn more about this because I'm not fairly sure about some of the aspects of your forest management, but not in this particular case. How about the inspections afterwards? Who's doing the inspections afterwards on a spraying site on state forest lands?
On state forest lands?
Yeah.
Or just all commercial timberlands?
Well, because commercial and state, are they exactly the same, or is there a difference in who does the inspection?
Our stewardship foresters would do the inspections, a post-op inspection on the industrial timberlands or private timberlands. For state timberlands, there's different buffer requirements as well there with the Oregon Forest Practices Act versus the state lands. Operations plans. I don't, on the state land side, do you guys have?
Yeah, well, one of our foresters, the programs are separated, right? And
okay.
You know, we have our own state lands foresters that essentially do the same work that the stewardship forester does on private ground to ensure that the protected resources are protected.
Okay. And he goes into every site and then does it after it's sprayed?
So on the private forest side, there's a lot of self-regulation, okay, and on the private forest side, we would respond to, you know, a neighbor concern or some kind of complaint, either, you know, prior to or after the application, on the state forest side, since we're employing a contractor to do that, we're on site when the application is occurring, and to just to double ensure that those protected resources are protected.
Well, let me explain to you a little bit. This initiative came up and it has some problems in it, but I think it's going to highlight in the future issues that, since the county is involved, we're going to try to ask more questions about how it's managed, how it's inspected, and these kinds of questions like I just asked you. I hate a little bit, I kind of jumped you in on this, but it's an important issue because forestry is such an important part of our economy in Lincoln County. But we hope to be able to have realistic conversations with all parties involved to try to come up with ways of minimizing and to ensuring that the public is safe in Lincoln County. So this kind of question probably is not going to go away, even if the initiative fails,
sure,
which the county came out and said, we think this is the improper initiative, but it's because of other issues than just the spraying. It's other parts of that that affects county government. So
sure.
I'll think we're going to go away on this one.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Is there a way to, or do you ever tabulate, like, say, would it be readily available, say, in the past fiscal year, how many applications there were in Lincoln County, how many were done by the state through contracts, how many were done on private land, how much product was applied, and what type of product?
So that information is all available. Mm-hmm. It is not currently tabulated, okay. I guess I think was the word you used.
Right.
It's nothing that we, could hand mm-hmm. to you right now. It would be something that we would have to pull together as part of a public records request, would be my guess.
Or if a citizen wanted to make that public records request, they could get the raw data and then do the tabulation.
Sure, it's all available. It would just take us some time.
Yes. And it might not be quite as accurate as you'd think. Mm-hmm. Just because somebody notified for that operation doesn't mean that they completed it as well. And we don't have any mechanism to see whether they did or didn't complete it. They're just notifying us that they would like to do that operation.
And when you said a lot of the private is self-regulated, but you respond to complaints, so in other words, does that mean there isn't a routine, always a routine inspection post an application, but if there is a complaint, you respond to it? And that's, I'm sure, a matter of resources, because, like, frankly, people ask us with our planning department, well, why aren't you dealing with a problem at such and such a site, that we don't have the staff resources to send people out looking for violations, but if one's called to our attention, we follow up on it. Something similar going on here.
Yeah, that's exactly okay. And that was with two stewardship foresters. Mm-hmm. We were having, that workload issue and just going down to one. Mm-hmm. You guys can see the problem that's going to create.
Sure.
So.
Sounds like to me like we better be fighting for your position.
We're trying. We're trying.
And if we can lend our voices, help, please let us know.
Sure.
Because this is our county, and we want to keep it as healthy as we can.
Absolutely.
Excuse me for taking a little bit of time here, but you mentioned watersheds, and I think it's classifications of forests. And one of the things that worries people is the protection of their water supplies for our communities. And can you give me any information there that might highlight anything on is there a difference between the way we protect watersheds and we protect generalized industrial forest land?
Sure. There's some different notification requirements and that kind of stuff when there's, in regards to, like, aerial or herbicide applications. That
basically just, any kind of spray applications.
Yeah, there's
inside
there's
of
some,
a community watershed.
I think the buffers are the same, but there's some different notification systems that we employ, basically to contact those local watershed managers, and that's just part of the Forest Practices Act that helps ensure that basically the landowner and the manager of those watersheds are in communication with each other.
Okay. Thank you. Wayne, please.
Just one procedural question, because I've been dealing with a lot of rural fire protection districts lately that, for their own purposes, are seeking to provide services to rural developed areas, and they're not necessarily within the district. So we've seen some more inquiries about annexations. And they're supposed to have a conversation with you guys. And Matt, I'm assuming you're the guy they talk to. I think R.C. Mock just did one for Siletz not too long ago, and I think you were the one he had a conversation with.
I can't remember exactly which one that was. But
yeah, it's Siletz Rural Fire Protection District. So, but you would be the go-to person, because we're getting more of these inquiries now.
Yes.
I think they're looking at the areas in which they serve and how they can best provide those services as well as raise appropriate revenues to do that. So we may be seeing more annexations than I've seen in a lot of years at the Rural Fire Protection District. So I just want to make sure to steer them to the right location. So.
Yeah, and you guys, I think I provided this page there.
Yes,
yeah,
perfect. That's part of our packet.
Yep.
Thank you.
So yeah, feel free to give me a call or email anything like that.
Great.
More than welcome.
Thanks.
Okay, so moving kind of back on to the fire protection side for this last year and stuff that we've currently got going. We've got two, I'll start with the grant stuff. I'll get to the PowerPoint at the very end, but currently we've got two grant areas that are Western States Fire Manager Grant, basically for fuels reduction around home sites and properties, that kind of stuff. One is up near Salishan, and it's being kind of managed and taken care of by our community wildfire forester out of Dallas. His name's Mark Desjardins, as well as one in the Harlan kind of Elk City area that's being managed out of Philomath by our community wildfire forester there, Pat McMeekin. So those are the two grant areas that we currently have in the county right now focused on fuels reduction. Those two guys are also helping, along with Charlie Redheffer, Jenny Damaris, and some other folks, basically make revisions to our Lincoln County Community Wildfire Protection Plan. They're right in the middle of that process now, and we hope to have that done by later this spring at our May Fire Defense Board meeting, I believe it is. So, shouldn't be a whole lot of updates to that. Some of the updates are going to kind of take some of the old grant areas out, some of the things that we've completed, and replace it with some of the new stuff that we've got, and just kind of freshen that up as well. And then just take a look at phone numbers and addresses and that kind of stuff, just to make sure everything's current. So not a whole lot going on there, but it is something that we've got to keep updated every 7 years-ish or so. Kind of along those same lines, our Lincoln County Forest Land Classification Committee, we're going to have our annual meeting next month up in Lincoln City at the St. Clair Fire Station. This will be year 5 out of 5. So basically when the classification first happened, after everything in the county was classified as forest land or not, we had to basically every 5 years relook at the county and make sure everything is still up to date. This county and this committee actually chose to take 20% of the county every year and just basically be continually doing a refresh on the county. So this is the fifth year, so this will complete our overall county maintenance schedule, and we'll be taking a look this year at kind of that Lincoln City, Rose Lodge, Otis area. So far, there's been no requests or appeals from any of the forest landowners on the designation of the property. And I don't anticipate any other changes as well, but it's something that we do take a look at. Currently, there's a committee in Salem working on our industrial fire prevention rules. They're basically the rules kind of aimed at fire prevention on the industrial logging side of things. A lot of this was to address some outdated rules and laws. Prime example of that is requiring a 2.5-pound fire extinguisher on equipment or vehicle when OSHA requires a 5-pound. So we're just trying to get some of that stuff back in line with each other. as well as addressing some new technologies and harvest methods. So when these rules were first put into play back in the 70s and 80s, the logging industry was much different. A lot of old growth logging, which there's an enormous amount of slash left in the units, and just a different harvest method. Now with harvesting smaller trees, a lot of whole tree yarding, there's less slash in the units, less of a fire risk per se. But so the new rules are kind of to address some of those, as well as some of the new technologies we have out there, the rotary hot saws and the feller bunchers, as well as looking at the new technology of tethered logging, where they're basically tethering a machine to a winch system and tethering it down off the hill, basically to eliminate people on the ground and try to make it safer. It's actually pretty fascinating to watch, just lowering a 60,000 pound machine off of a 50, 60, 70% slope. So, lastly, before I get into the slideshow here, you guys are well aware of the eclipse that's going to happen this summer. We're tied in with Jenny and the county in the eclipse planning process, and we'll see kind of where that goes and what comes of it August 21st. So we're actually planning for our department basically to have some extra resources on standby and available to us, as well as more than likely canceling days off for our seasonal folks, just to provide that extra staffing and support, not only for the eclipse day, but through the weekend as well. So, and a lot of that will hinge on kind of the weather conditions and what we see in August. But with that, August 22nd of this last year, so it's not too far off from the eclipse day, we had our 2500 road fire up in Lincoln Beach. So we'll just kind of start here. So August 22nd last year, about 6 o'clock or so, we got the report of fire. Report of fire actually came in several different ways. One of those with which Chief Williams called me, and it's kind of a funny story. He said, "Matt, you got any slash burns going on behind Depot Bay?" And that immediately raised a red flag to me, saying, if it looks like a slash burn, we probably have a problem, because at that time we didn't have any slash burns going on. He said, "Well, we have a significant column behind Depot Bay," and I said, "Well, what's significant?" I was just trying to get that picture painted in my head, and he said, "Well, you got an iPhone." He goes, let me call you right back." Well, he FaceTimes me, and he turns the camera around, and this is what basically I see, and my heart sank, and there's kind of that real bad feeling in the pit of my stomach kind of thing. I said, "Well, okay, we got," and by that time we'd have other 911 calls and stuff come in, and we'd have engines rolling, and a full response. So, initially that fire, we were initial attacked it there. It took us 45 minutes or so to get from Toledo up there, through the, and not knowing which side of the ridge it was on, potentially could have been on the other side of the ridge, which would have put it over into the Siletz River side of things. But we were able to access it off of the 2500 road fire, along with Depot Bay Fire. They were there to help as well. And actually, Assistant Chief Johnson provided some invaluable recon. He was able to get a hold of the medevac helicopter in Tillamook that they'd just done some training with, and they actually said, "Hey, if you guys have any other kind of missions that you would like us to do, give us a call. We're willing to work with you guys." So they were able to, later that evening — I've got a picture of it here later — but later that evening they were able to take a recon flight at night. Those helicopters are able to fly at night with their night vision capabilities, and get some really good recon information about where the fire was and where it spread to. It spotted at this time right around 3.5 miles, which is pretty significant for the Coast Range, really significant. So kind of some weather that day, you know, we were low 70s, relative humidity in the 40s and 50s, which is not you know, super concerning. That's fairly average. The wind, though, it was, you know, right out of the north, 25 to 30 miles an hour, and really, really strong gusts. And that's what drove the fire mostly, was the wind and, of course, the fuels that it was in. They were in old harvest units that still had some slash on the ground. And the weather just before this, so, you know, the 19th, 20th, 21st, I remember we were in red flag conditions here on the coast with very, very dry, warm conditions that really took all the extra moisture that those big, heavy fuels, that what we call 1,000-hour fuels, the big stuff, took that moisture right out and really helped to drive the fire. So, you know, as the pictures kind of indicate, we were experiencing some pretty extreme fire behavior, not only short, but, you know, very long-range spotting, so, you know, several miles away.
Did we ever find out what caused it?
We do know what caused it, and it's still kind of in the investigation phase.
Okay.
But that is being resolved. So that night, you know, this kind of shows some more of that fire behavior. But that night, you know, that fire you could see for a long ways. And one of the things that really kind of bit us was just the public relations, or not public relations, but just the PIO kind of phase of things. Things were happening so fast, and we had such a small unit. Most of our efforts were more focused on suppression. And then, you know, we do have a local PIO out of our office, but she is also one of our admin ladies, and she was busy with some logistical stuff, trying to get the guys fed and making sure we had some logistical support for them as well. During that time, we did lean on Casey and Jenny a lot, and it was extremely valuable just to help get that message out to folks in the county. I know Jenny was able to use the Everbridge system and kind of that reverse 911 to let folks know kind of what was going on, and Casey was able to jump on the county website and social media sites and relay that message. You know, just in the kind of day and age that we're in, it's pretty, people want information 5 minutes ago, you know, and so it's something our agency's kind of working on and trying to get better at on the public information side. But thanks to you guys, it was super valuable. So that next morning, the local Type 3 team came in. So basically, we had several hundred people there the next morning. I think I might have actually got my dates wrong here. Nope, 22nd. Okay. For some reason, I keep having the 21st in my mind, but that's this year. That next morning, you know, luckily statewide fire activity was very, very low, which was the first time in the last several years that mid to late August was slow fire activity for the state. So we, all the resources that we requested, we were able to get crews, engines, tenders. That night we actually had some local equipment there from Table Mountain Forestry. So we were able to get several hundred people there that next morning. You know, this thing took off at 6 o'clock at night. At 6 o'clock the next morning, we had several hundred people ready to go at the Depot Bay Fire Station there in Linden Beach. That was kind of our ICP, our incident command post, and we were able to really make some big strides that next morning. And essentially, the fire after that first night burning, the fire essentially only grew 10 acres or so for the rest of the period. So, you know, that was kudos to our initial attack crew to really find those spots where they could do good. You know, we were only a handful of folks and engines from not only our office, but Philomath and Dallas as well. But then that next morning when we did get those 20-person crews, the inmate crews, some of the aircraft, they were able to really hit the ground running and basically, you know, stop that thing as quick as possible.
So we were running both day and night shifts on the fire. So, you know, after that first night, you know, we were able to take some of those resources that we were getting in statewide and roll them into a night shift and really take advantage of the weather. You know, it's obviously cooler and more humid at night and really jump on that thing and mop it up effectively. So we were able to use that first morning or that next morning when that Type 3 team came in, which Type 3 teams are kind of just a piecemeal deal just to provide that overhead support as well as some of the financial and logistical support as well. But we were able to take advantage of our seat planes that we actually had stationed in Salem, at Salem Airport. In this video, I'll start it. When I took it, it took it in slow-mo, but maybe not going to work. Oh, well. But basically, a seat plane is that's a small, you know, you guys have kids or grandkids, Dusty, the crop hopper. It's those small, basically crop dusting type airplanes. They're right around 800 gallons. They usually run in tandem or twos, sometimes threes, and they're quite maneuverable, much more so than our big heavy air tankers, and they're actually quite a bit cheaper as well. They're initial attack qualified, so they don't have to have some of the other aerial supervision that some of those big planes have, and the reload plants that they're able to reload at. They're able to be moved around. They're just on big trailers versus, you know, having to go back to a big airport, that kind of thing. So if we would have needed to use them for quite a bit of time, we could have taken their mobile reload plant potentially and reloaded them out of the Newport Airport. So we did have a full functioning fire camp at North Fogarty Creek. So that worked out very, very well with state parks. So we were able to kind of develop that relationship that we've got with state parks, and because that was a day use area, not an actual campsite or fee area, we were able to use that as our fire camp location. We had basically full food there. We had, you know, our kitchens and stuff from Salem come in with the inmate crews. So we had breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We had showers and restrooms. There was a full fire cache with supplies, and then also the sleeping area. So that worked very well. That size-wise, I think we had right around 300 people or so in there at the peak of the fire. And so our thanks go out to parks for that. There's not a whole lot of other places on the coast where we could have got that many people, aside from like a high school or something like that. But kind of almost getting into the first week of school, you know, those places are limited as well. And then, like I said, we had our incident command post there at Glen Eden Beach Fire Station. So this is kind of a map of the fire. The red portions are the three fires that we had that kind of made up the complex. The fire started on the very north side of the north fire. And as you can see, just really, really wind-driven, and the wind was strong enough, it kept that ember shower in a really narrow path. Otherwise, we could have had spots. Honestly, driving out there, there should be no reason there shouldn't have been other spots as well. We got extremely lucky there. There's some other harvest units, one right up against Depot Bay that really had myself and Chief Williams pretty concerned. But we did have some plans in place with the local fire departments, not only Depot Bay, but Chief Ewing as well with the County Fire Defense Board to kind of have a plan in place for protection of Depot Bay as well.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I understand the top two together, but boy, that third bottom one is a long ways away from
it was.
The fire.
Yeah, it's right about three and a half miles from the first fire.
So there was hot embers that drifted 3.5 miles and then touched down?
Yep.
Is that common?
Not for us.
Not for here. For other parts of the state, that's very common. What we had that, you know, in the first couple pictures, that real large column of smoke, you know, those embers will be carried up in that column of smoke, and they stay very, very hot in that column until they drop out. And just with the wind, it pushed them 3.5 miles pretty quick.
A long ways.
So, yeah, it was pretty significant for the Coast Range.
So could I ask then, you mentioned about protection at Depot Bay, so mm-hmm. you were looking at potential scenarios even for
Absolutely.
Evacuation?
Absolutely.
That's...
Just because, I mean, it was not that far from Depot Bay, and there was some harvest units with slash very, very similar to the ones that the units the fires were in, right up against Depot Bay. Not only that, but about day two or three of the fire, we had some pretty strong predicted east winds or offshore flow as well, and that kind of got the hair on the back of our necks raised. At that point, we had the fire pretty well contained, but just, you know, things start to go awry when we get those east winds. So we definitely had a plan in place, as well working with the county sheriffs, just in case of an evacuation. Luckily, we didn't have to use it.
Yes.
So this here's just a picture of our local crew. All eight of those guys will be back this year. So as Ted said, we're not going to take the one firefighter reduction in Toledo. We'll take that in the valley. Part of that has to do with potentially having to take a cut in the stewardship forester position, which also functions as part of our overall militia for fire. But final size of the fire here was 202 acres. No structures were damaged, really no impact to the city of Depot Bay, aside from just kind of the smoke and the inconvenience of that. We were able to use about 900,000 gallons of water from the city of Depot Bay, which was very, very appreciated. We were able to hook into their hydrant system. There was no accidents or injuries on the fire, which is, for us and our agency, a very big deal. We strive for safety, number one. And overall cost for the fire was right about $1.4 million. So aside from the suppression cost, there was very little resource damage as far as to timber. Two of those three units were just recently harvested and not even replanted yet, so it didn't burn any seedlings. And that middle fire, so the middle one, only about, well, that was probably 30 or 40 acres, I guess, of seedlings that were just planted the winter before, so there wasn't a lot of time or finances invested in those seedlings yet. So overall, very minimal in the resource, but with costs of fires the way they are these days, you know, a fairly significant suppression cost. And then just kind of to wrap things up, that was one of 13 responses here in the county that we had on ODF protected land. And a total acreage burned of 202.73 acres. So 202 of those were that one fire. And that's the end of the report.
So I'm going to ask you a question about these vacant positions. I guess, which is the most important, the stewardship forester? They're under two different columns, but if they've asked for both of them, are they both equally important to your ability to function well in Lincoln County?
I would say without question the stewardship forester.
I know that you have to follow policies above you and you can't say anything, but would you mind, do you see any downturn if the county writes a letter in support of trying to keep that stewardship forester in Lincoln County?
No,
I don't. Okay. I don't think it would hurt.
Okay. We know you're.
Well, we can't lobby for that,
right,
if you're asking.
I'm asking you is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm selfish because it's in my office. So.
Sure. Bill, do you think we could?
I think that's a great idea. Yep.
To support this, because especially with what's gone on with initiatives and all that, I don't want to see any reduction in manpower mm-hmm. in this county that might impact any of the way we manage county forest or state forest land. So,
sure.
Mm-hmm. We'll take care of that. We could. Do we have an address exactly where this letter?
If we were to write such a letter, who would it be addressed to? Department director, governor, legislature? Or do you want to get back to us on that?
I'm going to let Matt get back to you. Okay. Let me do a little research on that, and he'll let somebody here know.
Would you send that to, to Bill Hall, and you just go to the county website? It is our contact.
Yep, I think I've got it as well.
Okay. And we can do that.
Sure. Glad to do that.
Yep.
Thanks, gentlemen. Really informative presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
I didn't realize the fire. I mean, I knew it was big and all that, but we've never got the details before.
Sure. Well, and we will, as part of our landowner community, our West Oregon Forest Protective Association, we'll have a summer tour this year as well. And more than likely, it will be out to that fire, and we'll get you guys invitations to that. And,
great.
And get you guys out there.
Thanks much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
I think we're down to done reports. We're down to commissioners' reports.
Yes. Well, let's stay on the subject of timber. On Monday, I was in Portland with probably half a dozen other commissioners from around the state, as well as maybe about 100 people total. This was a mass timber summit sponsored by Governor Brown and Business Oregon, looking at cross-laminated timber and other forward-looking timber technologies. And it was a really worthwhile day, in my opinion. You know, we had presenters not only from Oregon and California, but from England, from Chile, and from Japan, and especially in Europe. They're about 20 years ahead of us on this technology. We saw pictures and learned about, you know, 9-story apartment buildings going up in the heart of London built with cross-laminated timber. Chile is looking at it as a major means of addressing their housing needs. You know, I keep hearing not only in the U.S., but even in other countries because of economic factors, and then in Chile because of natural disasters as well. They're really looking to create a lot of housing very quickly. And the vision that, you know, really came out of this day was that with good, sustainable forestry practices, you can create a building material that is eco-friendly, that because, you know, as I've heard more than one person say, trees are the greatest mechanism for carbon sequestration known to humankind. And you can build quickly with prefabricated panels. You can, because it weighs so much less than concrete or steel, you don't need nearly as extensive foundation systems. And Oregon is really working to position itself as a leader in this. The very first mill in the United States certified to produce architectural grade CLT is D.R. Johnson and Riddle in Douglas County. Last year, the legislature funded the creation of what's known as the Tallwood Design Institute at Oregon State University, and a commissioner from Benton and I had a tour and talked to a couple of their leadership folks last week. So, you know, It looks like something that could revitalize the timber industry and be really one of those rare win-wins all the way around, I think.
Okay. So I spent the last 2 days in Salem working on legislation. Of course, nobody's got a solution yet for the PERS mess, but it's there are people working on it, but it's nothing's come forward yet, so it looks like there could be major cuts throughout the state. But I had 3 bills that I've been working on over there. One affected rural fire districts. It's to form a working group to see if we can create a economically viable way and to evaluate the disaster potential for rural fire protection when they build a building, to have space built there so that in cases of emergency they can house people. And several people said, oh, that bill won't go. We went into committee. Arnie Roblin did a great job, and we walked out of there with no answer yet because it has to go to a work session, but people that I think were pessimistic once they heard about it, and that Lincoln County is already doing food supplies for throughout the area, I think it shows that we have a potential. The problem is working groups, there's 103 bills in there that are asking for working groups, and it may just become literally, because they know there's no money, people mm-hmm. are shifting to create working groups so they can get the support of issues to go into the next session, hopefully when there'll be money.
Yeah,
so
study a problem.
If it gets lost, it isn't data. Because people don't support it because there's so many working groups out there. The other one, of course, is a working task force is the one on workforce development for the maritime industry to try to get, that's Doug Hunt's baby. We worked on it together, but Doug was gone, so I went over and testified. We also got a very good reception on it, and it should go into a work session in the next few days. And all of Gomberg was there and testified on two of them, was Arnie Roblin and other politicians. So it's unusual in a hearing where you have several politicians show up on a bill. That's a good sign.
Exactly.
People show up to support it, mm-hmm. that you're headed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I encourage those two to go. On Tuesday, I believe, the Coast Guard helicopter. The bill was drafted with Wayne and Rob's help since we have a change in administration in Washington, D.C., we thought we'd better reinforce the work that was done last time to ensure that the Coast Guard, we can retain the Coast Guard helicopter here in Oregon. But if you haven't paid attention, there's Sea Grant, NOAA, and the Coast Guard are all falling under cuts under this agency. So I'm really worried about all three of the major agencies here in Lincoln County mm-hmm. might lose personnel. And sounds like Sea Grant they're really coming after, which
talking about a total elimination, I thought I read in one report.
I'm like, yeah. How little knowledge can they have of Sea Grant to talk about a total elimination of a program that's been that successful?
But there are a lot of great successful programs that at least in the preliminary White House budget proposal are totally zeroed out. I mean, like the Corporation for National Service, which probably most people don't know that, but they know RSVP and Senior Companions, programs that are doing a tremendous amount of good for seniors in our community. Community Development Block Grants, that's another one that they're proposing complete elimination of. And you look around Lincoln County, our three Head Start facilities, Samaritan House, the My Sister's Place shelter, all of those, the single biggest chunk of financing was a Community Development Block Grant. So a lot of bad news for us in that proposal, but it's only a proposal. The president proposes, they say, and Congress disposes.
So let me ask you a question.
Sure.
You know, I've had a little bit of problem with all of your travel. When are you leaving for Washington, D.C. again, Bill?
Unfortunately, not scheduled to do that till next February.
But well, we may need you there before then.
Yeah, if there's an opportunity, I'm certainly willing to go if it's anything that can help protect our local resources. But, you know, Kurt Schrader was here on Saturday afternoon, and I think he got the message loud and clear that people want health care protected. They want these programs that are doing good in Lincoln County right now, keeping people safe and healthy, cutting them is not the way to go. And I think he is going to be in there fighting for us, as our senators are, but it's going to be an interesting year, to say the least.
Well, cuts of the programs in natural resources.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's a main part of our economy. We could take a big hit in Lincoln County if we lost major portions of the Coast Guard and NOAA mm-hmm. and Sea Grant. And not only that, a lot of it is the supports for industries. I mean, mm-hmm. We're going to have to do our own legwork on this one because we can't expect other people to do it for us.
No.
And we're the leader in this area of marine and mm-hmm. research. So I'll try to use my contacts.
You've got a good network of contacts. Commissioner Hunt has his network, and I'm president of Association of Counties this year. I think we're all connected in a way where we are well positioned to advocate for Lincoln County. And
your position in AOC could get you in a lot of doors that I can't get access to. So that's why I said
whatever we need to do, if there needs to be another trip, I'm certainly willing to go. Or if you're the one best poised, you know, we'll just keep those options open.
Okay. So now we're doing that constituent input. Is there anybody like to testify on constituent input? Please come forward and identify yourself. You can talk 5 minutes on any subject of your choice.
My name is Maria Soss, and I'm part of the group that's putting up the measure to ban aerial spraying. And I just have some questions about what was said about the regulations. I have here before me the notification that Depot Bay got. Depot Bay Hancock is going to spray there very close to their and along their water reservoir, which is their source of their drinking water. They got a notification of spraying, and it says that managed lands will be sprayed between April 1st and June 30th. Now, I mean, that's a huge span of time, and what does it allow people to do, you know, in that span of time? If the date proposed, you know, were something closer, people could seek protection. I mean, it won't necessarily protect their water reservoir, but people who live around there could protect themselves if they had a more specific notification. So that's one of my questions. Why notifications tend to always be such big spans of time that don't really allow people to know when it's going to happen. Then there is this $25 a year, I thought it was per notification, but I may be wrong, that people can pay, and they get a list of properties to be notified. I mean, they are the ones spraying things that are toxic, highly toxic. People have to pay to be told that they're going to be poisoned. You know, and when? I mean, that seems like a rule that is, you know, just, I mean, leaves me open-mouthed. When they talk about the mandatory buffers that they're going to be expanded, they didn't say anything about fish-bearing and non-fish-bearing streams. They just talked about larger and smaller streams. And fish-bearing streams, what has been happening in the past is that fish-bearing streams require buffers, but non-fish-bearing streams don't. And then many non-fish-bearing streams flow into fish-bearing streams. So there is a contradiction on that. They talked about, again, this is about, they talked about that private property are kind of self-regulated in the ways in which they require notification and no notification. And so people who know about the problem of pesticides will probably tend to go and pay their fee and get notified. What about people who have no idea that this is going on? And there are many, many people who don't know and don't understand the problems of pesticides. So they should be taken care of, you know, and it should be the responsibility of the people who apply the spray to notify everybody, if you're going to have spraying at all, which, of course, I don't approve of. Then here is the notification that Depot Bay just got of their spraying. It says there what's going to be sprayed. And the list says atrazine, glyphosate, hexazinone 2,4-D, chlorpyrifos, penoxulam, oxyfluorphen, and indazepam. Of those, atrazine glyphosate 2,4-D are extremely well known, and they're known to produce very serious harms. 2,4-D is one of the main ingredients in Agent Orange. I mean, even the federal government has had to acknowledge that this is a very harmful substance. I'm not saying that 2,4-D used by itself is exactly the same as 2,4-D used with 2,4-5-T, which has been banned, but it's still known to cause serious, serious health effects. About the other five, they have never been tested, and they're being released without testing. The idea being, once people start getting really sick, maybe they'll have some testing, just like atrazine and glyphosate and 2,4-D were only, they haven't been regulated that much. But I mean, it's after the fact. There's no precautionary principle here being applied. I'm not expecting you to be able to impose that, because that comes from much higher up. But the agencies that we trust so very much do not test. And more evidence is coming up that their statements about the safety of these products comes from bought science. They pay somebody to write a report that is not truthful. And this is really happening now. So I was very glad to hear you saying that you were going to be asking more questions. These are some very important questions to be asking. And it seems to me that spraying should not occur with this lack of testing. We shouldn't be used as the guinea pigs for finding out whether these products are harmful or not. That's what I needed to say.
Thank you very much for the information. Well, we have two meetings coming up. Why don't you tell me where the two meetings are at?
Commissioners, if I might, maybe I can help with that. Next week is a little bit, we're bifurcating our meeting. Wednesday, so we have the regular.
We're cutting it in two.
Cutting it in two. We're I like that term.
Yes. That sounds so lawyerish. Yeah,
so anyway, we're having our regular board meeting at 9:30, in which we'll take on regular business, and that'll include our constituent input. And then we'll recess at the end of that and come back at 2:30, and we're going to meet with some folks talking about the Oregon Fuel Action Plan report. Something that's in our emergency services arena that is extremely important for us to develop. I know the commissioners are generally aware of this particular item, but in order for scheduling for the folks that need to do the presentation, we had to make that at later in the afternoon, so that'll be at 2:30.
Okay. Well, we'll adjourn this meeting then. See you next week.
Thanks.